Okay, this is our next session on Day 5 of Walden Ultra. This is our session on literature, and we've been reading the story by Frederick Stewart Greene, The Cat of the Canebrake, in Sophie 23. What is the meaning of this tale? Anybody? Rose?
It seems to be a story describing the law of magnetism or attraction.
Okay, in what sense?
Well, she seems to have despised life with her very first breath.
Okay.
So from that point forward, that's exactly what she drew to her.
All right. Okay, other comments, input?
Carl, I just have a assignment I have to
admit to now. Oh, all right. Well, you can listen anyway. Anybody?
Well, and there were a couple of things in here that, you know, she was given the opportunity to change her attitude. One place where the double cabin of Jim Gant and its two rooms separated by a dog trot, an open porch cut through the center of the structure, was counted a thing of luxury by his scattered neighbors. But, she couldn't appreciate that. And then the other place where it says, she turned, scowling, and walked between the rows of growing corn that reached to the edge of the clearing. Here began the pine woods, the one saving touch nature has given to this land. So there she is going into this pine woods, which pine trees to me are always a symbol of aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
They are going straight to heaven. And I'm always inspired when I take a walk in the meadow and see those pine trees all around me, and they are just aspiring.
Right. Okay. Other comments about the meaning of this tale or the power? Let me ask you this question. Who's the most important character? Anybody?
Well, it seems to me that she is.
Okay, Rose votes for Sally. She's certainly the central character, but not necessarily the most important character.
I'm thinking the cat, because it created sort of the climax for the story.
Okay, I think I agree with you. After all, it is called The Cat of the Canebrake, not The Babe of the Canebrake. And not only does it create the climax, it is the foil for Sally throughout the entire story. From almost the first first page, she's interacting with that cat and throwing it out of the cabin.
It was almost a manifestation of herself.
Exactly. All right, we can summarize this story as follows. Jim mistreats Sally, who seeks comfort outside with Bob. Bob tries to draw Sally away from her misery, but Sally mistreats the cat as badly as Jim mistreats her. As so often happens, Sally returns the abuse she believes Jim is expressing toward her. Instead of working to create a better situation at home, she therefore seeks escape. But, which of course, the possibility of which is provided by Bob. but life does not brook escape from karmic suffocation. When she plots to get Jim drunk so she can slip off and run away, the cat intervenes and takes things in his own paws. Now, is this a gothic tale of horror or just the horrific implications of ordinary life experiences?
Well, it explains cause and effect.
It explains cause and effect. In what sense?
Well, I mean, if she hadn't mistreated that cat, well, even in her sleep, the cat came by, and she was so reactive to the cat that even in her sleep, the presence of it near her, she threw out her arm or something, and that's when it dropped the snake.
Right, okay.
Which then...
The snake's head.
Bitter.
Yeah, well, the snake was not alive. It was... Jim had gone out, killed the snake, left the... chopped off the head, and he was talking about how the fangs were extruded and it was spitting poison even after it died.
Mm-hmm.
The cat went out a few hours later, found the head, brought it back in, and dropped it on Sally so that the fangs pierced her body.
No, it was when, I thought it was when she moved her hand to brush the cat
but,
away.
The point is that
and then
it was the
went in.
Head of the dead snake mm-hmm. that hours after being dead pierced her skin and poisoned her.
But if she had loved the cat, and when she felt its presence, even though asleep,
right.
like Perry gets in bed at night, and you just put your arm around it. Instead,
right.
she was forcefully, again, trying to drive
So you're suggesting
away.
This is more a Greek drama of retribution than a gothic tale of horror. Well, it's a possibility. Any other ideas? Let me ask you this. What is the irony of Sally's death?
Well, it says she got old Jim drunk, so when she needed his help, he wasn't available.
That's right. He was unconscious.
He was drunk.
So she trapped herself. She could have been saved if she could have roused Jim.
Yeah, because he could have sucked the poison out.
Yeah, but... because of her scheming and manipulativeness, she basically tightened the noose around her own neck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, this would seem to be a story perhaps about fate. Did fate punish Sally, or did she create her own destiny through cause and effect?
Mm-hmm.
Rose has already voted for cause and effect.
That's my vote, too.
Okay. Two votes for cause and effect. Well, it's easy for us to see this in those terms, but keep in mind that children reading this story, this is their first confrontation or encounter with these kinds of ideas and these types of movements. And
they vote for horror.
They vote for gothic tale of horror. Yes, you know. So what are the allegorical meanings of this story? Anybody? Okay, can you speak up a little bit? Get closer to the mic or something? Okay. As a man thinketh, or in this case, as a woman thinketh. Other comments? Well, what about the fact that they live in such dirt poor poverty?
But everybody around there did.
Okay. But so what?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So what? So what?
Well, it means something to Sally.
Well, that was just another thing she resented.
Okay, but why did she resent it if everybody else lived in greater poverty?
Well, she obviously brought that seed of resentment in with her from past lives.
Okay.
I mean, you can't maybe say that to kids, but...
Well, it doesn't matter what about the past lives. We can understand that, but was Sally propelled into poverty, or did she create her own poverty?
Well, you always mentioned poverty is really poverty of thought.
Well, it can be, yeah.
So I'm thinking that she created it. I think we create our circumstances.
All right.
There's a couple of paragraphs from As a Man Thinketh that talks about character.
All right, go ahead.
Says,
speak up so everybody can hear.
Thought and character are one, and as character can only manifest and discover itself through an environment and circumstance, the outer conditions of a person's life will always be found to be harmoniously related to his inner state. This does not mean that a man's circumstances at any given time are an indication of his entire character, but that those circumstances are so intimately connected with some vital thought element within himself that, for the time being, they are indispensable to his development. Every man is where he is by the law of his being. The thoughts which he has built into his character have brought him there, and in the arrangement of his life there is no element of chance, but all is the result of a law which cannot err. This is just as true of those who feel out of harmony with their surroundings as those who are contented with them.
Okay.
I mean, that's Sally.
All right. Well, let me ask you this further question. Was Sally a victim of Jim or Jim a victim of Sally? And what about the cat?
Jim were victims of Sally.
I was agreeing with that.
And that created...
How is Jim a victim of Sally?
She was manipulating him, and just created tension. She wasn't being sort of a full partner in the marriage.
All right. Anybody else?
Well, I think she probably married him thinking her life would be better, and then, of course, nothing was really going to make her life better except her changing her attitude.
Okay, I think you can go a step further. Anybody?
A step further than...
Than
what?
That. I think... If you read this carefully, by which I mean thoughtfully, I think Jim was a success in life, and that's why Sally married him. He had a two-room dog trot, this is like living in a double-wide in a trailer park, which is otherwise filled with rundown singles. You would be the king of the trailer park if you lived in the only double wide. We know about these things down here in Georgie. But, so all we know about this is that he built this dog trot, this double room dog trot on with his own labor.
That was after they were married.
And about the time they got married. Because he built it so that they could live in it. And shortly thereafter, he seems to have lost all ambition and turned to drinking. Now, it's as though Sally vampiristically drained Jim of his ambition, and they slid further and further in poverty, even though they had this potentially nice house. He had the ambition and the drive to build this better than any other house in the neighborhood house. What happened to that? The only clue we're given is that they got married. And obviously, Sally treated him like dirt. That's all we can assume because he went and hid himself in his bottle. And there's plenty of evidence that she nagged him all the time and treated him as an inferior because he comes in at the end and boasts about killing the rattlesnake, and she says, well, what kind of a rattlesnake was it? And he said, well, you know, you'll probably be able to sell it for 4 bits in town. And she said, oh, ask 6 bits at least. Now, this could be being a supportive wife, but what the underlying implication is, you never do anything right, Jim. You can get more money for it. And I need that money. This was even after she had decided to run away with Bob. But it was just her automatic response. Nothing he did was ever good enough for her. And I think you can make a strong case for the fact that she sucked all the ambition out of the poor guy's life. So, yeah, I agree. Jim is a victim of Sally. Did Bob represent the ticket to happiness?
No, she probably would treat Bob and suck his ambition out of him as well.
Quite possibly.
All she was thinking of was the amount of money he had saved.
Right. And how fast she could go through it.
Mm-hmm.
So, the question is, was the effort to escape just a trap of fate?
Well, it would seem so.
Right. She saw it as her ticket out of this godforsaken area of Mississippi or wherever it is, Alabama. But in fact, it was no more of a, I mean, there was no way she was actually going to go away with Bob. She was trying to escape Jim, and the situation with Jim was entirely of her own creation. Every aspect of it was of her own creation, including the way she treated the cat. So, I think what we have to understand is it does not take very much kindness to win the affection of a cat. And Sally lacked even this very, very small measure of kindness. You feed the cat once or twice and the cat will come and entwine itself around your legs and purr. If you pet the cat a couple of times, it'll do the same. It recognizes you as a source of food, a source. Instead, the cat loathed Sally. So we can assume that she treated the cat as just an extension of Jim. And the cat symbolized everything that she saw wrong in Jim. And in fact, she defined the cat as an object of fear and converted him into a killer. So what does this tell us about how we should live our life?
You should do a lot of mental house cleaning.
Gotta do a lot of mental house cleaning.
And make sure not to let any negative, harmful thought reside in your mental household for a second after you discover it.
Well, would that work for Sally?
Well, of course not, but
I think what we have to conclude about Sally is that she has to confront her basic vampirism first. She is totally on the take. She expects the world to treat her like a queen. It never occurs to her to do anything to win the affections of others. There's nothing in the story to indicate that she did anything to compensate for the fact that Jim built her the best house in the region. All she did was ruin the man. We have very little knowledge of anything beyond that, but we have to go with what's in the story. So, let me ask for other input here. Other perspectives?
Because she did not take a look at and confront her way of looking at the world, her self-centeredness, and her drive to create chaos in her husband's life. She died, so she never had a second chance in this lifetime.
Okay. So what's the meaning of her dying?
What just popped into mind was your fable about the crab and
the crab, Kayla. Michaela.
Well, the crab or Taurus, or no, was it the crab? The one that says, oh yeah, how could even a crab be that stupid or something?
That's fate, yes.
Yeah.
Fate says that.
Fate says that. That's basically what fate was telling her.
The crab cursed fate as it died.
Clinging onto its own arm.
Right. And
so she basically,
fate says, just chuckle as a how can even a selfish crab be so.
That describes the story,
yeah,
right there.
There you go. This is part of learning to build a structure of association as you see the relationship between, say, the cat in the canebrake and that fable.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in a sense, she poisons herself. And the snake may be representative of all the venom that she had developed in her lifetime.
Okay.
So
again, what is the meaning of her death?
Don't tempt fate.
Well, that's a good point, that the two men are now free to rebuild their lives and tap their native ambition a little bit more fully. We can imagine it'll take Jim a while to even sober up before he can do that. But exactly, there's. So you're suggesting that her death is a liberation for not only the two men but the whole damn county, probably. Good. What else? And the cat. Well, the cat was a agent of justice. What else? If you were to teach this to, say, fifth graders, what would you help them try to understand?
To think about their attitudes and the thoughts that they have can lead you down a path of positive living or negative living.
Okay, can you get more specific than that?
The attitude and the way you think about yourself and others can greatly affect the outcomes of your life and others.
Okay. Rose?
It would be an opportunity to teach children about building right human relationships.
Okay, what else? In addition to building right human relationships, what can be taught to the children? Okay, that's good to teach responsibility. Can we unfold that particular onion a little bit more? Peel that onion a little bit more.
That is one person. Each person has a role or can play a part in positive living in your household, in your community.
Okay. In fact, what you've just suggested might be a way of approaching it with a classroom of young students, and that is to have various members of the class do role play. Somebody be Sally, somebody be Jim, somebody be Bob, somebody be the cat, somebody else be the canebrake and trampled all over.
Those chickens she threw in the back of the wagon.
Yeah.
See, she even treated the chickens badly.
All right.
They had their legs tied up, and she just
threw
them into the back of the wagon with no concern.
What do you want to conclude from that?
She was just a mean bitch.
Well.
I mean, she was.
What about if you haven't read the story, but I'm just thinking something that is loveless is lifeless.
Okay, that's fine, but going back to Louise's idea of responsibility, what is Sally's responsibility? And you might be able to figure this out easiest by role-playing her part. What is Sally's responsibility in this story? How could Sally have avoided this tragic end?
Well, she would have been a loving, supportive wife.
How would she get from being Sally to become a loving, supportive wife?
A number of lifetimes.
She could have tried drinking herself.
I'm not sure maybe she was able to. Well, I mean, she really maybe did need to go back and start over.
Well, this is a work of fiction. We're allowed to pretend that she's able to.
Okay, if you
pretend.
Well,
she's saying she's a vampire, so that means she's living off
contributing.
All right. I think it's pretty good, especially in this modern day and age, it would be very effective to bring up the fact, is this an allegory of vampirism? Don't talk about psychic vampirism, just psychological vampirism. And there are several other writers, like Mary Wilkins Freeman, who have written stories. One of them was in Sophie years and years ago. But this is an example where she's sucking him dry, and his only way to try to repair the damage is to drink, and that's his only comfort. And yet she then nags him about drinking, and so how does a vampire, other than having a stake driven through her, how does a vampire, what could she do to become a better human being? There obviously has to be a way, or we'd have vampires all over the place. And of course we do, but this is a particular kind of person that whatever they do, they suck you dry.
Well, it's just a total self-absorption.
Okay, it is a total self-absorption, but how do you help people break out of that? If Bob was such a hotshot engineer and if he had any understanding of human nature, what could he have done to help her short of falling in love with her and trying to seize her for her own, which was just her spell over him?
Well,
there was this brainwashing. He was being vampirized as much as Jim was. You gotta help me, Bob. You gotta help me. I'm so lonely and I'm so upset about life. You gotta help me.
Well, I mean, he thought he genuinely loved her.
Yeah.
And yet that love didn't have an impact on her.
Right. Neither did Jim. Jim was willing to support her and live with her.
So I don't know how she would be able to overcome it except by going back and starting over.
All right.
Maybe she needed to be rejected herself.
Well, I think that happened big time.
Yeah. I mean, by the Met, if they both rejected her.
Well, except that I think this is the type of psychological situation where she's able to spin a web that almost no man could escape. This is Fatal Attraction. This was way ahead of Fatal Attraction, but you know, in Fatal Attraction, the guy just thought he was going to get a little something on the side, and she spun a web that led to murder and death and all kinds of things. And Jim just thought he was falling in love, asking her to marry him, building her a house, and then look, you know, it destroyed his life. So we can't leave kids in school thinking, well, if there's a vampire, all you can do is drive a silver stake through her heart. There must be a way to help her grow. Even if it's not likely to happen in one lifetime.
Well, I mean, you try to love the best within her. It is in there somewhere. And you smother her with so much love that even a vampire, it's too much. I don't know.
Smothering
would
with love.
Would that work? You just radiate love and goodness, goodwill, just all of the beautiful qualities of life. You try to unfold her in those. And
well, you drive a silver stake through her heart.
But a cross protection
yeah.
Right, so you could wear a cross around your neck, under your shirt, and she wouldn't know. She wouldn't understand why she...
But you're kind of getting close to the answer here, and that is that, of course, she has no experience in examining her own life, of reviewing what impact she has. No capacity to take blame for her mess. All she can do is look for ways out, people to manipulate. She expects the world to take care of her, period. Doesn't matter who, when, how. She can't see any value to the cat because the cat doesn't take care of her. She has to take care of the cat. So this is the problem, is that she has this foundation which is godless. There's no morality, there's no humanity here active. She has no ethics that anyone can discern. She's willing to cheat on Jim just as a matter of self-interest. She's willing to run off with Bob because Bob has more money than Jim. And at heart, the big picture here is she has no core. The only thing that's lovable about her, and even that isn't all that much, is she has a kind of captivating charm or look. But
it was the best looking thing in the neighborhood.
Yeah, she was the best looking thing in the neighborhood, and that was not saying very much.
That was not saying much.
And obviously in 10 years she wouldn't even have that. But down within her character there was nothing there. So the answer here is the value of building character. Now, we can't possibly imagine Sally waking up one morning and seeing herself in the mirror and saying, I'm an empty hag, I have no character, and start going out and buying the works of Aristotle to find out how to be develop character. That might happen in the movies, but it wouldn't happen here. But what's important, why this is a very illustrative story for children, is the teacher can say, this is why you need to build character and learn to think and learn what it means to escape the trap of selfishness. Because you're the only one who can do it. If you don't do it, then you're going to get trapped in by life and killed or disappointed or whatever. And then if all you know how to do is blame somebody else, blame life itself, you have no strength to respond with. Now, what on earth does that remind you of? Well, this is an easy one, guys. Who in modern life refuses to accept any responsibility for what's Obama. Going on and blames everybody but himself?
Obama.
You nailed it in one. Well, I'm not sure they're quite as compulsive about it as the Big O. But you see, that's the underlying problem here, is that when you scratch the surface and get to the character, there's no evidence that there's any character there. There's only vampirism, trying to suck off the productivity of the productive members of society and pass it on to the non-productive members. That's vampirism at a national level. Oh, Nancy got it. She typed in Obama. So again, for the only way to handle this is to recognize the utter absence of integrity, the utter absence of character. And this is what we're demonstrating, or having demonstrated to us. When his ideas falter and fail, because there are no ideas, he resorts to blaming everything but himself, and it's becoming abundantly clear, even to Maureen Dowd and others on the left, that he's no leader. He has brought nothing to the table. All he can do is demand that others take care of him and take care of the people he claims to represent.
Let's hope the problems.
Let's hope that the Tea Party is the cat.
Well, exactly. We the people must be the cat. And I was thinking about this today. This particular episode in history should maybe give us pause to consider that, you know, there have always been people who have advocated a single term of 6 years for a president. You get elected, you serve for 6 years. You don't get to run for re-election because that way you don't have to spend all your time going out on a bus tour through the Midwest.
Which is what he's doing.
My contention here is that maybe we need to think in a different way, and that is to limit the presidential term to the same as the House of Representatives, to 2 years, so that if we get somebody that's a walking disaster as the current president, we can vote him out after 2 years. He would have been voted out in a landslide last November had he had a two-year term. I would be in favor of letting presidents serve as many as 3 two-year terms, but having to stand for re-election every 2 years.
Oh, yeah, because 6 years would have been a disaster.
6 years under Obama would have been death for this country.
Oh, yeah.
4 years under Obama becomes a near-death experience. So I think this is a warning shot from above, the people above, that we have to see what is happening here. And there is no character. Just as Sally has no base of character and basically cannot get one unless she's recycled probably a number of times, we need to recycle the president, not by any violent means, but by simply diselecting him, choosing somebody else. We could take a page out of the books of Wisconsin and demand a recall, but there's nothing in the Constitution that allows that. Impeachment is the only option, and there's absolutely no way our political system is going to impeach the first pseudo-black president. I say pseudo-black because he's actually Arabic, not black. He's an Arab-American, not an African-American. All right, any final thoughts on the cat and the canebrake? I think role-playing is an excellent way to get young students to identify with stories, with fiction. Now, obviously, this is a story that wouldn't be read at least until high school because it involves mature concepts that eight-year-olds don't really understand. But I'm sorry?
My kids know all about alcohol.
They know all about alcohol. All right.
I'm glad you said high schoolers just now because I think you had mentioned fifth graders before, and that has been going through my mind. I thought this was a little bit much for fifth graders.
I don't think I mentioned fifth graders in terms of this story, did I?
Oh.
I think it was the earlier section with proverbs and fables and stuff.
Oh, I thought it was within this
story. No, I think this would be way over their head, and they wouldn't get the, about the best that you could hope for is to say, well, I love my kitty cat. I would never treat my kitty cat that way. But no, this is a story for mature minds and maturing minds. All right. I think we have come to the time for a gong. And we move on into our next section, which is, here's our man, Aristotle, up on the screen. And this is our concluding session on his book, The Nicomachean Ethics. Any comments about reading this book before I launch into it? Have you enjoyed reading it? Have you been enlightened by it? Has it been thought-provoking? Is it difficult to read in Greek? Well, of course, it is repetitive because he's using the same template to resolve different philosophical dilemmas.
Yes.
Ethical dilemmas.
I don't think you can read a lot. That would be my concern by saying this course. That for me, I have to go so slowly and just take one aspect of what he's saying. The move to something else is too.
Well, you need to learn the art of slow reading. We have speed reading. I have never in my life attempted to learn speed reading, although I've gotten to the point where I can read Alice Bailey at a fairly good clip. But there are certain types of reading in which you have to read slowly. This is one of them. All right, there you go. All right, anything else before I launch into my prepared remarks here?
I'm
little over halfway finished and found it challenging, but I've appreciated reading it. I don't think I read this in college. I read some other Aristotle, but it's very thought-provoking. I'm really appreciating the discussion around it as well.
Okay. You know, the interesting thing is that Aristotle, Plato, all these things are now left to college, and you're only going to read them in college if you take a course in government or and read the Republic or Aristotle's Politics, or if you major in philosophy or take a course or two in it. And that is such that represents the impoverishment of modern higher education. This should be read in middle school to high school. Now, you might think that it's way over the heads, but if the whole point of this is he gives a very practical technique for reconciling the pairs of opposites and heading for the golden mean. And if it's taught in those terms, then students can be well prepared to understand the more adult applications of it when they study it again in college. But they're getting exposed to it in college, and it's like this tornadic blast that is likely to blow them away rather than enlighten them. But in 300 years ago in schools, or when you were tutored, you grew up reading these things as you learned Greek. You read it in the original Greek, and in order to read and have practice reading Greek, you read Plato and Aristotle and Ovid and Sappho and all these things. And that's been totally dropped out of our educational system. Okay, well, let me go on and talk some. Aristotle started his ethics, the Nicomachean ethics, by stating that the ultimate goal of humanity should be happiness. Remember way back when, on the first day of the class, we talked about that. But as he develops his thesis, it becomes clear that happiness must be tempered by virtue or it's false happiness. What then is the true goal of human growth and behavior? Anybody? You may not have gotten far enough in Aristotle to have captured all of his ideas on this, but any discussion?
I'm way behind.
Well, so am I.
Oh, are they? Okay. I'm just way behind on that.
Well, Aristotle seems to suggest that it's a state of self-mastery, of self-control, a state in which our character becomes progressively more capable of acting with virtue. Yet this does not lead to happiness as much as control of character, action, and understanding. And we can think back immediately to the case of Sally in The Cat in the Canebrake. How can we apply the idea that we all pursue happiness, that the goal of human life is the pursuit of happiness, to Sally? To Sally's thinking, it's the pursuit of selfishness that leads to happiness. It's the control of everybody else. It never occurs to her to turn inward and control herself, to control her vampirism, her needs, she's way to the end of every scale that Aristotle draws. She's way at the end of the perverted baseline. The ethics of action are to be complemented by the ethics of the mind. Justness, nobility, harmony, peace, and beauty. These are not learned from experience, but through intellectual exploration and discovery. Aristotle lists 5 stages of mental achievement. You may have gotten to this or not, doesn't much matter. He lists 5. The first stage of mental achievement is art the ability to rebuild, to create? Knowledge, the ability to master facts. Practical judgment, which we would call common sense. Wisdom, which is the ability to synthesize meaning and power. And intellect, which is driven by abstract truths. So we have, in Aristotle's approach, art, knowledge, common sense, wisdom, and intellect. And these are the five aspects of developing the mind, of mental achievement. Now notice right now the congruity between, I wouldn't normally point this out, but since we're all on the same wavelength here, the congruity between what Aristotle has just said and D.K. talking about in his various books, the number of associated with the mind is the number five. We have five senses. We have five senses mentally, five senses emotionally, five senses physically, and through these senses, we develop our awareness and understanding of life. But it's this is the mind with five aspects, not the other way around. And that is the template for physical action. So again, the five stages of mental achievement, according to Aristotle, art, knowledge, common sense, wisdom, and intellect. It seems reasonable to me to conclude that these five levels of mental mastery should be the goals of any educational system, especially one and grow. It is my insight into the nature of these that although they can be understood in terms of a personal pursuit of truth, they can only be activated with the help of spirit or higher mind. They all require the presence of the higher mind overshadowing and guiding. So between you, me, and the lamppost, even though we might not advertise this, the purpose of any education is to reveal the presence of the higher mind and help children learn to contact it. That means that the work of elementary education is to master the basic principles of learning, good study habits, as they are usually called and never defined. So the first 4 years of education should be devoted to establishing good study habits, the core of which I think is proper respect for your fellow learners, proper respect for your teacher, proper respect for your fellow learners. In a Walden Grove, it would be the ethic of honesty would be taught from day one. Thou shalt not cheat. Because if you cheat, you're cheating yourself. You're letting down your fellow students. You're falsifying your own capacity to learn. One cannot learn anything based on a structure of cheating. The work of middle school is to teach intellectual skills and the basic principles of self-mastery. In other words, you learn self-control. This is the work of middle school because this is exactly the period of time from when, 5, 6, grades 5, 6, 7, and 8 correspond to ages 10, 11, 12, and 13. The time of coming of age, of moving into adulthood, adolescence, puberty, etc. The time when the emotional body is suddenly working overtime. And this is what the well-focused mind is meant to control. We are, what makes us human beings is our capacity to choose not to do something or to choose to do something else. Self-mastery is nothing but one intelligent choice after another. And there's no repression, no restraint. It's a question of saying, for example, I'm not old enough to make intelligent decisions about who to have sex with. So I'll wait a couple of years until I have a better chance of making that decision. That may not be a popular idea at first, but it's something that children can relate to, that they're in control. They're not doing this because their parents expect them to do it. They're not doing it because they'll ruin their lives. They're doing it because they have the power to make an intelligent choice. And if they don't yet have the maturity to make an intelligent choice, the only intelligent choice is to defer making up your mind until you do. We, as an example, we are approaching the problem of obesity in our society as though the fat kids don't have anything to do about this. It's not their fault. The fault lies with McDonald's. The fault lies with Coca-Cola, even though they have a Diet Coke. The fault lies with everybody but government and the children. Now, I would say that the primary fault lies to the government that releases information that suggests that you have to consume 300 carbohydrates a day in order to maintain health. If you consume 300 carbohydrates a day, you're going to end up fat, I guarantee it. Obese, porky, pudgy, whatever you want to call it. So the government is behind this with this, 150 to 200 carbohydrates a day. Unless you are a football player or going home from school and plowing the fields for your daddy on the family farm, you don't need 300 carbohydrates a day. But that's an example where it's not to listen to Michelle Obama talk about it, it's not the children's fault, it's the diet, it's the parents' fault for all of this. Well, it's something that the children can learn. Children need to learn just to say no. They don't need to consume enormous amounts of starch and sweets. They don't need to consume a box of Ho-Hos every day.
Carl?
Yes.
Back to the sex thing with high school kids, a good discussion would be, all right, if the government's going to provide free birth control, you've had that choice too. If you choose to use that, you're almost tempting yourself not to make a good choice.
Right.
You know, and that they would have a choice.
And I think this is where there needs to be some active discussion about if you sleep with somebody who is your boyfriend or your girlfriend at the age of 16, are you forming a bond that will last the rest of your life, or is it something to just walk away from? What is the problem of promiscuity?
What's the Colin Wilson book?
The Colin Wilson book is The Labyrinth of the Gods.
It ought to be reading for
anybody. Well, decide. Maybe senior and high school reading. But it's not available in print, I don't think. It's a book that is very saturated with sex and quite graphic. But it establishes very clearly the point that if you have sex with somebody at the age of 16 and then you go your separate ways and you're in your 30s and that person is in her 30s or vice versa, and they suddenly have a mental breakdown, even though you haven't heard from this person for 20 years, you are psychically tied to that person and will have much the same response of a mental breakdown as they're having.
Be depressed and not know why.
Yes, you'll be depressed and have no clue. And so, now, we can't talk about that in normal schooling. I can talk like that with you. But you have to talk about it, and it would be useful to talk about it in terms of what are the dangers of promiscuity? Well, one of the dangers is that if you get a girl pregnant, you are expected by your community to support her and your child for at least the next 20 years.
No, not now. The government is going to
provide. Yes, I know. The government is going to provide everything.
You know.
But that's there's a link there. The link is called Your Shared Child. And whether you walk away...
the Brother's Keepers thing.
Yeah, well, this is your children's
yeah.
That's the one area where you are.
My point, too, is just that we talked about Aristotle talking about the highest qualities, maturity, self-control, and the government is just giving such mixed messages.
Oh, absolutely. Now, the point I'm making is that if you start studying Aristotle at least superficially and then deeper and deeper, when you're, say, in eighth grade, seventh or eighth grade, you get accustomed to the way Aristotle thinks and writes, so it's not Greek to you. When you get into high school and you need to have this conversation about sex, you've got his concept of balance. What is a balanced approach to sex? He obviously lists incontinence as a sin, an evil, one of the three. We'll talk about this in a moment. But what does that mean? It doesn't mean that you're a 60-year-old and you can't make it to the bathroom. Not that type of incontinence. It means that you can't control, you refuse to control your sexual impulse. You refuse to make decisions. You go with the flow, literally. Or a better way to define it is you explode with the flow. And so the model of Aristotelian thought here of the pairs of opposites and achieving the golden mean as a balance is a great model that kids can understand if they've been properly introduced to it. Then the work of high school is to reveal the inspiring component of the mind and to link art, knowledge, common sense, wisdom, and the intellect to higher intelligence. Now, those are broad classifications. Obviously, you're also studying algebra and geometry and all different kinds of things. But there should always be the sense that these insights come from the higher intelligence, not the other way around. In this light, education becomes a schooling not only in thinking and learning, but in assuming responsibility for ethical behavior. It's the duty of every child and their parents raising them to enter adulthood with a mature set of ethics guiding his or her acts. Now, my question is, do our modern schools provide this kind of instruction? When children graduate from high school, do they enter adulthood with a mature set of ethics guiding their acts? Either from school or from church or from home?
Most of them learn it from their peers.
What do they learn from their peers?
Not what you would want them to. No, and that's what happens. They follow their peers, and they're not learning a higher model, a lot of them.
That's affectionately referred to in some circles as the dirty version from the kids in the street.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean...
In so many instances, parents have learned that thing. We know what, in many instances, public schools are teaching kids now. So where do they get it from? I mean, if they haven't, there are children who have been mature parents who have guided them from infancy, you know, and perhaps have been in a school setting, probably a private school. You know, I know that they're not perfect either, but they may have gotten a little bit more ethics.
Well, I don't think so. But I will say this, that I think... The greatest likelihood of this occurring is with homeschooled children. Because by definition, a parent that wants to homeschool the child, which is an enormous undertaking, is a parent that's inclined to teach responsibility and good study habits.
Because even when I think of public school, we have very good teachers. it's a little thing. It's a group thing.
Sure.
You know, everybody just buys in.
Well, there's the other aspect of public school is that public school system encourages parents to think, I send my child to school, the school educates my child.
Yes.
I have nothing to do except encourage the child to get good grades. And that's corrupt. Yes, Rose.
Well, this actually goes back a ways, but I would say that my Catholic school education, which was first grade through the eighth, we really were taught respect. If it was respect for our teacher, which was a nun,
or at least respect for the ruler with which she
yes.
beat you.
And, you know, respect for our fellow students or whatever. And we were in, like, a huge classroom where one nun would teach. She would teach the fifth grade, and then she would go over to the other side of the room and teach the sixth grade. And that was your study period. And believe me, nobody messed around.
Right.
You had respect, you were quiet, you did your homework while she was teaching another class. So there was discipline that, I mean, when I went to high school then for the last 4 years, because there was no Catholic high school, I mean, the difference, there wasn't, you know, you made fun of the teachers, you didn't respect one another, there were cliques and all that sort of thing. So there really was a difference.
You, instead of going back, you actually went forward, because later in this lecture, I'm going to actually, believe it or not, praise Catholic schools.
Oh, well, it was something you said back a ways that made me think of this.
All right.
And that's my praise, because I'm often dumping on it.
Yeah.
But it really gave me a solid baseline to go forward.
Good. Any other comments before we move on?
Well, I just a quick one, and I do think there are parents who are instilling good ethics in children, and I do see that, and
well, of course,
positive things. But in general, I have heard the statement so many times from business owners, especially in fast food kind of establishments, about the work ethic, and some of them really think twice before buying such a business or establishing it because of the change in the work ethic in the country.
Okay, that's a good point. Let me ask you this question, everybody. Are the riots of the youth in Great Britain a sign of ethical maturity?
You really want us to answer that?
I want that. I'll take it.
Well, it's more to the point that they actually quoted some of these people as saying, we're sticking it to the rich.
Right. That was amazing.
And they now have the ethical standard among the youth of Great Britain that if you disapprove of what the government's doing, go out and torch a few police cars and burn down a firehouse or two. Which is stupid, because they're burning down their own government services, the ones closest to them.
I was going to say, so now it's a good idea to go ahead and cut off your nose to spite your face.
Right.
There were no consequences for you there. There were no consequences.
Well, there's also no future. All right, is the support of, I don't mean to step on anybody here, but is the support of unions by teachers a sign of ethical maturity? Are the cheating scandals that have rocked Atlanta and other places a sign of ethical maturity? In Aristotelian terms, what are they signs of? And, of course, Aristotle lists three options: evil habits, incontinence, or brutishness, savagery.
If you look at Wisconsin, there was some...
Right. Are they succumbing to evil habits, to incontinence, or brutishness?
I'd say brutishness.
All right, that's an interesting point. Why would you say that?
Attacking. They were attacking anything that didn't serve their needs.
But they had the right to attack, didn't they?
They made a literal pig pen out of the state house.
Right. This is my point. It's a point that we'll touch on briefly at the end of The Secret Knowledge. David Mamet quotes Saul Alinsky, and he talks about Saul Alinsky advocating a shit-in at the Chicago airport, where they would clog all the toilets in the airport and on the plane so that nobody could fly. Is that a bad habit? Is that incontinence, or is that brutishness? I vote for brutishness, savagery. Only a person who has no sense of civilization would think of doing that. And the point is that there are certain people who are troublemakers. And again, as Mamet points out, Obama was schooled in Chicago politics, and he comes right out and uses the word I've used, that is the politics of thuggery. In other words, there is a core, but it's a rotten core. It's a savage core. It's not a civilized core. We have to be part of being having integrity in our mind is to recognize a bad apple when we see one, and to say this is just a thug in a three-piece suit. Rose.
So, are these people part of a whole group of people who incarnated at this time, and they used to be the pillage and rapers or something like that?
Still are the pillage.
Yeah, because they still are. That's what they're bringing forward. It's just take what you want, vandalize, you know, cause all this havoc.
Yeah, well,
it almost seems like there's a whole group
sure.
that has come in for this purpose.
Right, for the purpose of being the foil for those of us who want to establish a stronger sense of ethics. The public needs to see the ludicrous result of Aristotle's three evils. Evil habits, incontinence, and brutishness.
So then this almost goes back to the cat in the canebrake.
Of course.
Because you ask us, how would you help Sally? So we can say, how do we help this group of brutes? I mean, we're sort of trying to pull them forward, I guess.
Absolutely. But we're not really aiming at them. We're aiming at society, which elects them.
Right.
Or tolerates them or mm-hmm. approves them. And so the enemy is not the administration. There is no enemy. The goal is to lift up mass consciousness in society to the point where it rejects the welfare idea. It rejects the nonsense of poverty. Yes. Who is Dorothy? Were you going to say something?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, maybe it was Mimi. Somebody
maybe
was.
Mimi was thinking out loud. I was agreeing with you, and I was thinking through the whole discussion about the cat and the canebrake, that it seemed we were talking about how to help Sally, but I was thinking about Dr. Lightman's book and your book on mind control. I'm not getting the right
brainwashed.
Brainwashed, and we really need to teach that lesson and how to recognize and how to uplift ourselves and our own character and standards to the point where we're not going to be affected by that. And also, in doing that, we're going to help to lift up those other people. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, you want to give love and understanding, but it may not be accepted. It may not, you know, the only way it's going to work is if that person is ready to learn. But if we all work together and moving up the standards, then we eventually help them as well.
Right, that's the purpose of mass consciousness. If we move the median point of mass consciousness from 50% to 51%, we've made an incremental improvement which lifts up the lower 51%. It and establishes a new mean, a new standard, a standard where we recognize the wolf in sheep's clothing. All we're talking about here is simple discernment of the wolf in sheep's clothing, the asshole within the outer veneer of a suit. Did you have an additional comment? Now, ultimately, a set of ethos, and this is what Aristotle's talking about, the development of an ethos. Ultimately, a set of ethos is nothing more than a series of choices made by each individual as he or she grows up. Usually, by the time you hit 21, 22, that's fairly stable. And if you've been guided lovingly, you have a good set of ethics to guide you. Sometimes you realize later on, my God, I was misled and I developed a bomb-throwing ethic and I shouldn't have done that. And so you go back and revise. Sally was incapable of going back and revising. The work of school as an institution should be to encourage students to choose in favor of a life of virtue rather than a life of vice. They have that choice. They can choose a life of virtue or a life of vice. They can choose vice. But if school is working well, they'll never choose a life of vice. They need to choose a life of self-control and restraint rather than a life of incontinence. And a life of civility and helpfulness rather than one of brutishness. This is not because altruism is good. It is, but it's not because of that. It's because it promotes the greater good for the whole society, and brutishness does not. Any idiot can go out and torch a bus. That doesn't contribute to humanity. Those of you who attended Catholic school, even for a few years, know the value of being taught moral principles as an adjunct of education. It can be done. It's been done brilliantly or less than brilliantly for hundreds of years. These principles become a core that guide you throughout your life. I did not go to a Catholic school. I went to a public school. But during that whole period of time, I was attending church and going to Sunday school and doing other things and going to Boy Scouts. Going through the whole Boy Scout program. And between the scouting and the church, I got an excellent education in ethics. Didn't learn it in school, learned it in church and scouts with the support of my parents. And this model needs to be not thrown out in the name of separation of church and state. It needs to be expanded and made much more effective. That's the work of teaching ethics effectively in Walden Grove.
Hello?
Go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm not sure. Was that Mary? Go ahead, Mary. I have a question.
I was just going to say how significant Walden Grove and the classes are small and will have a sense of mentoring because it's going to give the teacher a chance to approach each of the kids, and to figure out and learn not only their learning style, but where they're at, and to invite them, you know, to this process.
Sure.
Whereas it's just going to be ideal.
By the way, on that score, this is one of the reasons why I anticipate uniforms in a Walden Grove school. Not because I have any desire to teach conformity. But rather, this is a simple, easy way to, A, eliminate the superficial competitiveness of I look better than you, I dress better than you, and which is is rife throughout public schools and the high school levels and earlier. But more importantly, it teaches there are rules. You have a choice to follow the rule or not to follow the rule, but life is much easier if you take the rules as frameworks for self-expression rather than limitations. Nobody's ability to learn or grow is thwarted by wearing the same uniform as everybody else. It promotes a sense of identity. It makes it easier to respect each other because you wear the same clothing. And it teaches very easily. It makes easy the lesson that there are certain expectations that being a student here, you must agree to fulfill. Yes, Rose.
Well, it's really just one less distraction, which they have plenty of.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's one less distraction.
Right.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. You don't think about it. The kids aren't going to be thinking about what they're going to wear tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's an example of ethos. The uniform is an expression of the ethic of being a Walden Grove student. It has nothing to do with conformity or uniformity or anything of the nature. It is has everything to do with these are rules, you follow them, and you put your mental talent to work understanding the other rules of getting along in society, the rules of civility, the rules of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Other comments or questions?
I had a comment real quickly and then something to throw out as a question. But I was, and you had mentioned too about this being a manual for ethics, and I was thinking, yes, it's great to have it and teach a universal model so that it can be applied to any situation. Which I was thinking about situational ethics. What level or which of those three? Where do you think situational ethics would come in? I'll just throw that one out.
Oh, what are they?
Looking at.
Well, it could be all three of them. My vote is probably for incontinence. The inability to control what your actions, and therefore you hide behind the guise of incontinence. The example of this, the easy example of this is gambling. And the reason why for years and years and years society did not have lotteries, now states have lotteries, is it encourages the incontinence of gambling. The problem is not the act of gambling. The problem is that the non-professional gambler doesn't know when to say, I quit. Doesn't know when to fold the hand. And so they keep on gambling thinking that they can beat the system, even though intellectually they should know that they're going to lose in the long run. The professional gambler can only win by knowing when to quit. So the inability to say no and turn it off is incontinence. The inability to say no when you are presented with, if you're a guy and some babe walks into your office at work and strips down and says, let's have sex, and this would be a disaster to you on all scores, assuming it's not your wife. If it's your wife, that's a different story. But the presumption is it's not. The ability to say no is continence. Incontinence is, my God, I never knew life could be so good. You see? It's a trap. It's a trap just like the cat in the canebrake. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and then I want to mention your point about incontinence in relationship to gambling.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I have heard that gamblers will be unable to leave the table in order to go to the bathroom.
Right.
And will leave themselves right there because they cannot stop. So it was a good,
That's a genuine demonstration of incontinence, yes.
Exactly. But I wondered, you know, with continence, do you, I was thinking about that and thinking of people who are incontinent. I'm not even sure that they think about ethics. I don't think they're capable.
Well, now, please, that's not entirely true. Because obviously one of the great voices of ethics and morality was William Bennett, and then it was discovered that he had a problem with gambling. And he knew he had a problem with gambling. It was a compulsion. Now, here's a case where, and I think this was a morality play played out for our edification, that you need to do more than tap the meaning of ethics, you need to tap the power of ethics. He is an expert on the meaning of ethics and morality. He did not have the ability to tap the power. Now, the good news was he had the money to afford his bad habit, but this was an evil habit and an example of incontinence. We need to learn that ethics, he struggled with this, and we should be compassionate towards anybody struggling with any addiction, and yet we should expect them to overcome their addiction. And the basis for doing this is to not only, I mean, I think he had a Catholic background. He knew what was moral. He didn't have the power to resist his own personal demons. So that's an interesting aspect of this. Okay, that's the end of our morning classes. It's now lunchtime. It's lunchtime. We will resume at 2. Remember that if you have final editing or things to do in rewriting your presentation, our presentations will be this afternoon in extended oral presentation section, which will be from 4 to 5. And so everybody will have their chance to present their independent research project, their findings. So,
are you suggesting then that people will read what they've written?
That's exactly it. You can dance it if you want, but I don't know how you're going to convey that to me. But yes,
okay.
We will individually read what we have put down on paper. So if nothing else, have some notes and some basis, and I'm looking forward to learning all about the laws of divine life. All right, that's it. Thank you. See you at 2:00.